This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, good to see you again this week.
Yes, good to see you as well.
And I have a question for you right off the bat. How'd you sleep last night?
Very well, thank you.
Do you always sleep well?
Yes, so far, so good. Early to bed, early to rise. That's me.
You always are so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. That doesn't surprise me. What about when you had cancer years ago? Did you ever have difficulty sleeping then?
I don't remember that I did. I think I remember I would wake up sometimes during the night. And I can
say, in a cold sweat?
Sometimes. Yeah. I can say that one of the things I've noticed when it comes to sleep is I am a lighter sleeper now than I used to be. Used to be I could drink a cup of coffee on my way to bed and still sleep like a log. But now it's kind of those, oh, it's too late. It's too late in the afternoon. Can't have any caffeine now.
Well, situations. Part of that's having kids, isn't it?
It must be.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, you're worried about them and afraid one of them will wake up and be sick. And, you know, there's a thousand reasons why people don't get a better night's sleep. And interestingly, the CDC, the surveys, one of them from the CDC says that somewhere between a quarter and a half of all people in the United States say they're not getting enough sleep. I suspect that's not too surprising with all of the devices we have to keep us awake and all of the stress in our lives. But there are people who have difficulty sleeping, and then there is the condition called insomnia. And in fact, to be a true insomniac, you have to, number one, feel impaired during the day because you didn't get enough sleep. You have to be stressed by the condition, and this has to last for more than a month. Otherwise, you just have difficulty sleeping. But if you meet those criteria, you might be a true insomniac. And fortunately, that's less than 10% of people who fit that medical definition of having true insomnia. Nonetheless, we know that losing sleep or not getting enough sleep can have some real negative effects on your health. So today's program on sleep.
Absolutely. We're going to talk with two sleep experts. Dr. Eric Olson of Mayo Clinic Rochester is here in studio with us, and Dr. Joseph Kaplan of the Mayo Clinic Jacksonville campus. We're going to get some advice on how to get a good night's sleep without taking any medications.
No pills needed, hopefully.
We'll also talk about sleep apnea. How do you know if you have it? What are the health consequences? And are there treatments other than a CPAP? And as I said later in the hour, Dr. Kaplan is going to join us to talk about overcoming sleep problems if you work the night shift. Workers have their very own sleep issues.
I can understand that. I've never worked. Have you ever worked an overnight shift and had to try to sleep during the day?
No, but I've worked in morning radio when you get up at 4 a.m. and that felt like a weird shift to me.
Yeah, there's all sorts of things that can interfere with a good night's sleep, aren't there?
Yes.
All right, so let's meet today's in-studio guest, Dr. Eric Olson from the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Olson, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
So you are, by trade, what we call a pulmonologist. You specialize in diseases of the lung, but you do a lot of work in the sleep center. How did that happen?
Correct.
What's the connection there between the two?
You know, sleep is a relatively new medical discipline, so people didn't grow up in sleep per se, so all of us came to sleep via different routes. I came via pulmonary because one of the most common conditions we see is a breathing disorder in sleep apnea. But our colleagues in psychiatry, neurology, ear, nose, and throat, dentistry, psychology, all have come to sleep as well because of the vast number of disorders within that discipline.
So you don't spend all of your time in the sleep disorder center, right? I mean, you still do lump people with lung diseases, but okay.
I do.
And is that true of most people who work there?
Correct. So most sleep specialists do wear multiple hats. So they will do sleep medicine, but also their primary discipline as well. So in my case, that would be pulmonary.
One of the things that we're going to spend a lot of time talking about, and I suspect we'll get quite a few phone calls and questions about, would have to be snoring and apnea. And as we were getting started this morning, I said, is all snoring apnea and is all apnea snoring? And we're talking about two different things.
Correct. We're really talking about two different points on the same spectrum. And that spectrum is, how wide open is your throat at night while you're sleeping? all of us, when we fall asleep, have some relaxation of our throats, and so there is narrowing that occurs. If that narrowing is of a certain degree, you start to get turbulence of the air crossing through your throat, and that vibratory sound is what is okay. snoring. Mm-hmm. It's just a sign that your airway is getting narrowed. People can then go on to actually close their throat off at night, so it relaxes to the point of complete blockage, and that's when apnea comes in.
So can you have sleep apnea without being a snorer?
That's extremely rare. So the converse is true. You can snore. In fact, most people who have snoring don't have sleep apnea. But if you have sleep apnea, almost always you've been a snorer or are a snorer.
Are most patients who have sleep apnea, diagnosed with sleep apnea, obese?
Obesity is the major risk factor for obstructive sleep apnea. So yeah, it's a very common attribute of the patients we see with that disorder. But you don't have to be obese. So for instance, in children, one of the most common risk factors is just having large tonsils, even if the body weight is normal. Or for adults, people with jaw disorders, for instance, that can place the tongue in a position that's farther back within the mouth and throat can be at risk, independent of their body weight. But obesity is the number one risk that we see.
Little children that snore should probably be, that should probably be addressed, correct? That's not right?
Well,
is that normal?
It's just like an adult, you can have snoring that doesn't necessarily mean a problem. And in children, that can evolve with time as the ratio to their tonsil size and the throat size tends to change with growth. But I think if there are other features with the snoring, the child is a restless sleeper, doesn't sleep well, hard to wake up in the morning, having behavioral or performance problems at school during the day, those are signs that that may be something more to be worried about.
So you can be a snorer and not have sleep apnea, but if you are a snorer, you're at risk for being a sleep apneic. How do you know if you have sleep apnea?
So about a tenth of snorers, people who snore habitually, probably have sleep apnea. So how do you know if you're in that group? So the main things would be if you have a bed partner who can observe what's going on at night and give you some clue. So for instance, if you're being told that you're actually witnessed to stop breathing at night, that's a very powerful risk.
And that's what we mean by apnea. You
correct.
Actually stop breathing.
Correct. Correct. If you don't have a bed partner, then things to look for would be if you snort or choke or maybe gasp yourself awake during the night. If you're not aware of those things, other clues may be just awakening unrefreshed or having a headache when you wake up either in the night or in the morning or not being at your best during the day. And for most people, that's sleepiness. It may be fatigue or just not performing well.
So if you have sleep apnea, you're not getting a good night's rest is the implication.
Correct. So the link there is that to start breathing again at night, you need to arouse from sleep. So after you've paused for a certain period of time, your brain will recognize something is not right. And it will literally bring you up out of sleep. Not to the extent that you recognize
remember
that.
It, sure.
Because those arousals are just seconds. But that nonetheless, that damage is done. It would be as if someone was kind of nudging you all night or maybe playing a tone in the room. Mm-hmm. That was just at some level enough to disturb your sleep, but you weren't aware of it.
And isn't there pretty big concern that people who have that can die during the night because of that? I mean, at some point your brain just says, I'm tired of waking you back up again.
So
you're not worth saving.
I'm tired of this. It's been every day for years.
The mechanism may be different, but you're right. One of the consequences of really severe obstructive sleep apnea is premature death. But there are other more common side effects. It can affect your blood pressure. It can affect your cardiovascular disease risk. It can affect your metabolic profile, like diabetes can be a side effect of having advanced sleep apnea. So it touches so many things. Death would obviously be the most serious, but there are many, many disorders that people struggle with that they probably don't recognize might be linked to their sleep apnea.
And I know from other shows that we've done, there's that downward spiral kind of that if you don't get enough sleep during the day, you tend to overeat to find the energy that you don't get from sleeping,
right.
Which makes you heavier, which makes you the apnea worse, which just downward so it goes.
So that's a really unique thing right now because there clearly have been two societal trends that seem to be linked. One is we're not getting enough sleep. And two, we seem to be getting heavier as a society. And whether it's because of sleep apnea or, as Tom mentioned earlier, just simply not getting enough time to sleep at night, it does seem to influence your eating choices, your opportunity to eat, and those are in a way that tend to promote weight gain.
Well, we'll talk more about the treatment and, of course, the CPAP machine and how that works and the problems with it. But let me just ask you before we break, is this a diagnosis that you can make by history alone, or do you need to bring someone into the Sleep Disorders Center and have them spend the night there to be certain they have sleep apnea?
So obstructive sleep apnea is diagnosed via a sleep study. So whether that's done in a specialized laboratory or more and more of these tests are being done at home, but we do require that objective information from actually monitoring breathing during sleep to make the diagnosis.
Your spouse can't make the diagnosis.
They can point you in the right direction, and usually that's how it happens, but they can't quite make the diagnosis.
They can also get a good night's sleep when you're in the hospital doing the sleep study.
Exactly.
They'll notice the difference.
Well, along that line, I just would throw in, we did a study, and it sounded like spouses of sleep apneics could lose up to an hour a night of sleep because of all that's going on next to them in the patient with apnea. So it really affects both members of the couple, not just the person with the disease.
Wow, important to get him treated. And it's mostly hims, isn't it?
It is. Generally men. As women go through menopause, though, they catch up. And especially if women are overweight and are postmenopausal, then the risks seem to be about equal. But by and large, it is more disease of men than women.
Oh, interesting. They catch up at menopause.
Oh, good. Love to make up that lost ground. It is time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with our experts here about sleep and insomnia, Dr. Eric Olson and Dr. Joseph Kaplan. Plus, myth or matter of fact, you might be surprised on this one. You can make up for lost sleep on the weekends. Myth or fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news, at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for in-studio guest Dr. Eric Olson. He's a sleep expert. Our number, 507-282-1234. Or leave us a question on our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Or you can always tweet us, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We're back right after this. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio, Dr. Tom, my partner Tracy, and our in-studio guest, Dr. Eric Olson from the Sleep Center at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And we'll also be joined by telephone in just a few minutes from a physician in Jacksonville, Dr. Joseph Kaplan.
During the commercial break, which is when all the great conversations happen, I said, you know, I get really frustrated that I think Americans understand logically that good nutrition and good sleep make you feel better. But I think that it gets lost that if you want to improve your health, you should add better nutrition and you should add better sleep. And you said there's a study that was done that is astounding. You have to share that with us.
Yeah, there's a really interesting study done with healthy subjects that were either allowed to just spend 4 hours of time in bed, so they got sleep deprived, or 10 hours time in bed, so they were sleep repleted. And then they looked at the hormones that control your sense of hunger or your sense of being full. And in the 4 hour time in bed group, those hunger hormones just exploded. And whereas in the 10 hour time in bed, then you were much more likely to feel full and not overeat. Simultaneously, if you looked at just the foods that those subjects craved, in that sleep-restricted group, there was definitely this craving for energy-dense, high-carbohydrate, high-fat foods.
Cheetos and ice cream, Tom. Yep. Cheetos and ice cream.
It's better stay in the rack a little longer.
But it does, you know, we have a tweet here, you know, I don't get enough sleep. How do I get more? Lots of people posting that on Facebook. It really does make a difference in your health.
Absolutely. And for most people, it's just a matter of prioritizing. You know, is there enough time in the day to do everything you need to do? And usually the first question we ask people is just where does it fit in terms of your priorities?
Sure.
All right. Myth or matter of fact, a lack of sleep during the week can be made up over the weekend.
You know, I would say that that's true to some extent. That
Hold
is a
on.
Fact.
All of our Facebook people said myth, 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 except for Fuad and Joanna said fact.
Yeah.
It is a fact.
I agree with those two. You can't fully make up for not getting enough sleep during the week by just sleeping on the weekends. However, to pay back a sleep debt, that is the time you don't get at night on a typical work night, doesn't have to be made up hour for hour. So by sleeping in on the weekends or napping, you can, to some extent, make up for sleep that hasn't been achieved during the week.
I was so surprised to hear that. I thought that would be a complete myth. And then I was surprised when the follow-up question I asked you was, okay, sleeping in or taking a nap, which was better? Because I thought for sure a nap, but no.
Well, by and large, we tend to think that getting your sleep in one block is better than trying to break it up. But with that said, getting sleep is the most important thing. So if your schedule only allows you to do that by nap, then so be it.
If there's anybody who likes to make up sleep on the weekends and catch a nap whenever they can, it's someone who is a shift worker.
And you know, we have a lot of those
where we live,
and it's because there are a lot of places like two major hospitals and an emergency room that are open 24/7.
Right.
So we have a lot of shift workers in this town, similarly in Jacksonville and all over the country. There are people who are working during the night when the most of us are sleeping, and that can create some sleep problems.
Dr. Joseph Kaplan is on the line from Mayo Clinic Jacksonville. Good morning, and welcome back to the program, Dr. Kaplan.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for having me back.
What is a shift work disorder? I didn't even know there was such a thing as a disorder when it comes to sleeping and shift work.
Sure. Of the workforce, about 20% of the 150 million people in this country who work shifts. And in Asia and Europe, it's even worse. And about 10% of those suffer symptoms that we would classify as shift work disorder. What it is, as you may have already discussed, we all have an internal sleep-wake biologic rhythm that approximates a 24-hour day. And this rhythm wants to make us sleepy at certain times of the day, hopefully at night, and alert during the day. Some people cycle a little bit more than 24 hours. Some people cycle slightly less.
Huh.
And light, external light, is the main influence or cue that keeps us on this schedule. So shift work disorder is a mismatch between the sleep-wake schedule required by an individual's job and their own biologic rhythm, their own intrinsic day-night clock. So when they have to work, their internal rhythm wants them to sleep, especially if it's night shift. And when they have to sleep, their internal clock wants to keep them awake. So this is a disorder where patients, and it's about 10% of those who work shifts, suffer either insomnia or excessive sleepiness on the job, and then difficulty getting to sleep at home.
So those would be a couple of the symptoms. Sleepiness on the job, difficult sleeping when you get to home. Are there some other symptoms that people could tag?
There actually are a lot of symptoms. It can cause mood disturbance. And what we worry about is impaired performance. A lot of these nighttime jobs are people in the transportation industry or emergency services or public service, police, firemen, and we worry about them having problems with their performance. And then in addition, some of these patients, there's a high rate of depression in people who have to work night shifts consistently or rotating shifts. And then there's some data that suggests a significant increase in gastrointestinal problems,
wow,
cardiovascular disorders, and a lot of other symptoms. So it's really an important condition that affects a lot of people.
I'm going to stay on the day shift.
Okay, yeah, you should. I would think that a night shift would be easier or better than a rotating shift.
It is. So if you have to work shift work, a consistent night shift is the easiest to handle for most people. Now, there are some people, and we believe this is genetically determined, that never adjust to a night shift. So let's say you're starting a job on a night shift, and that's going to be your regular shift from now on. It takes about 14 days to completely shift your schedule.
Hmm.
And what's important is you've got to keep the same schedule the days you're off, that the days you're working. You can't go back and forth from awake at night and daytime sleep, and then on your days off, you're going to do awake during the day and nighttime sleep. But people have demands on them, and they want to take those days off and be awake to be with their families and
sure,
do other things during the day.
So what have you got to help these people cope with shift work?
Sure. As I said, straight night shift would be the easiest. Rotating shifts in the clockwise rotation, in other words, you might work the swing shift 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. this time, and then the night shift the next 2 weeks. The slower the changes, in other words, the longer you can stay on any shift, the better you are. then it's easier. Then if you have to rotate counterclockwise, or if you have to rotate rapidly, those are the most difficult shifts to kind of accommodate yourself to.
Sure.
But basically what we tell our patients is to, if you're going to start on the night shift, you need to be fully rested before you start. And preferably if you can get a nap about 6 to 8 hours before the shift starts, that will help. Early in the shift, bright light has been shown to be very important. And some caffeine probably wouldn't hurt. Later in the shift, you want to avoid caffeine. And then on the way home, it's important to avoid light. So what we're recommending is dark sunglasses for the drive home. Sunglasses that will transmit 12% of light. It's okay for driving, but to dim the external sunlight that you might see. Then, as soon as you get home, you need to start your daytime sleep period in a completely dark bedroom with opaque materials on the windows to eliminate light, a cool, comfortable room, and try to get your 7 to 8 hours of sleep at that time.
It's kind of like jet lag.
Yeah, you got to block out all the light. Hey, Dr. Kaplan, thanks so much for being with us. Great advice. Really appreciate your taking the time to call in.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
All right. And one more myth or matter of fact before we go to break. A stiff drink or a glass of wine before bedtime will help you sleep. Myth or matter of fact?
It will help you get to sleep, but it's very poor to help you stay asleep.
So you're not a big fan?
Not a big fan.
How about melatonin?
Melatonin would help with the things Joe just talked about, like shifting your internal clock. Not a great sleeping aid.
All right. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest, sleep and insomnia expert, Dr. Eric Olson.
Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. And after that, we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234. Comments from our website at radio.mayoclinic.org. And hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We got all kinds of tweets coming in. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Here's promising info for people with type 1 diabetes. The latest way to do islet transplantation. That's when clusters of insulin-producing cells called islets are transplanted from a donor pancreas into another person's liver is showing improved results for people with type 1 diabetes, and it may offer a more durable alternative to a whole pancreas transplant. The new approach, which allows the transplanted cells a short period of rest before transplantation, resulted in increased levels of insulin production, so much so that patients no longer needed daily insulin injections. Researchers say this is a promising method for islet cell transplantation, and the study was published in the journal Diabetes. And now let's talk about donating blood. As few as 3% of Americans eligible to donate blood do, and fear and anxiety are common reasons why many decline to give. U.S. hospitals are always in need of new donors, and at Mayo Clinic, that need is heightened by concern about iron deficiency in frequent givers. So Mayo recently began requiring people to wait 12 weeks rather than 8 between donations, a change that means an estimated 10% drop in its blood supply. Now, some people are afraid of needles, seeing blood, and fainting, but donation centers help you deal with those issues. Here's Dr. Manish Gandhi with more about blood donation.
There's always someone who needs it, and unfortunately, it's always the sickest of sick person who needs blood, and it's the blood which makes the difference between life and death for them. If you have to take flu shots, you can consider this like taking a flu shot, but at the same time, you're helping at least 3 people by one whole blood donation.
And now news about chronic pain. Our bodies respond to pain by releasing what are called endogenous opioids, compounds that deal with acute pain. Researchers have found when our bodies release opioids to deal with a traumatic injury, they also develop a long-lasting opioid mechanism of natural chronic pain control. And the body develops both physical and psychological dependence on this system, just as it does to opioid narcotic drugs. Now, in the study, they figured out in a mouse model that if you block the body's natural opioid pain system, even a long time after pain from an injury subsides, pain comes back. And the body also goes through withdrawal symptoms. This suggests that opioid pain relief silently continues long after an injury is healed. In other words, your body's painkillers continue to put the brakes on pain. The authors say that stress could interfere with this process, leading to chronic pain, such as that associated with conditions such as fibromyalgia. The study was published in the journal Science. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Information you want from specialists who know. On air, online, you can always get us on your smartphone on iHeartRadio. It is time for you to join our conversation. Three ways to do that. Our telephone number, 507-282-1234. Or you can contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or tweet us, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Eric Olson, insomnia and sleep expert, 507-282-1234. I have a couple of quick questions. First of all, I heard you two talking during the break, and Dr. Olson said that one of the sure ways to help yourself get to sleep is to try and keep yourself awake. Interesting. Paradoxical.
Correct. So a big problem with people who have longstanding difficulties sleeping is that they basically have learned that pattern, and they start to develop an anticipatory stress that only is magnified at night when they're in bed lying awake. And like many things, the harder you try, the more elusive that goal can be. And so one way to help people get to sleep is to actually try to have them focus on staying awake as long as they can. So the goal becomes different, but the outcome is what's desired. That is, as that mind gets distracted, it's easier to fall asleep.
We got a tweet from someone saying, sometimes I wake up wide awake at 3 a.m. or 5 a.m. I don't need to be up until 7 a.m. Is it better to force myself to fall back to sleep, or should I just get up for the day?
So the first thing we'd want to know in that situation is, what time is that person going to bed? Because if they've already had 8 hours of sleep or sleep opportunity, there's no point in trying to go farther. There's just no biologic need to do that. But presumably, if they're at a conventional bedtime, let's say 10 or 11, and waking up at 3, what we typically would advise is to not lie there in bed and try to force yourself to get back to sleep. We would recommend that people get out of bed and try to distract themselves by doing something light and not very stimulating. So, for instance, reading in a dim light or maybe meditating, and then going back to bed when you start to feel drowsy. Rather than just lying there in bed, often people will look at the clock at that time, and that just builds that frustration as time passes. And the goal is, again, to get that mind off that elusive goal of getting back to sleep, get it distracted until the drowsiness comes back.
You know, at the beginning of the hour, Tom, you mentioned, you'd asked me about cancer, my cancer experience in sleeping, and I didn't remember it. It's been so many years. But we have had a couple of tweets from people saying, I have had awful insomnia since my thyroid cancer. And another person that said, why is it so hard to sleep when you have cancer? Why can't you sleep? So what is the experience with cancer?
So a couple things. First of all, the symptoms caused by the cancer, pain, can be very important and obviously disrupt sleep. The other is just the psychological stress of having such a devastating diagnosis. I mean, that just weighs heavily, whether you're in the throes of diagnosis, going through treatment, or in the recovery phase. So that is very powerful and has an impact on sleep. And the other thing is the treatments that are rendered for cancer, whether it's surgery and the recovery from that, or chemotherapy, radiation.
The prednisone even.
Prednisone, all these medications that are used can be devastating on sleep. So it's probably a combination of factors. But as I said earlier, remember, with people who have perpetual difficulty sleeping, that those patterns start to get established where you start to anticipate that you're not going to sleep well at night. So even after the acute throes of the cancer and the cancer treatment have passed, those patterns can become established and need to be broken.
All right, we still have one line open at 507-282-1234 with sleep disorders expert Dr. Eric Olson. I have one quick question.
Yes.
And I've always wondered about this. I am jealous of people, and I know they're out there, who can sleep 3 or 4 hours a night, and that's enough. There are such people, right?
There are, we call them short sleepers, and they probably do get by on such restricted sleep.
And has anyone ever studied these people long-term to see if it has any effect on longevity? You would think if you didn't rest your body that much, it'd wear out sooner and you'd die younger.
So I'm not aware of a study to cite you, but I think experience would tell us that those true short sleepers do fine. They aren't at increased risk over the years.
And are there a lot of people who think they're short sleepers, but they're really, you know, 6.5 hour sleepers instead of 4.5 hour sleepers?
Yes, that type of individual is far more common than the true short sleeper.
Go to bed. 282-1234. Good morning, Joe. Go right ahead with your comment.
Just listening to all this, I've kind of come to the realization with my own sleep patterns that I don't think the human body's caught up with civilization, and I think our issue started with the electric light. I'm a CPAP user. I've read this book, No More Sleepless Nights, by Dr. Peter Hari. That's what my physician recommended.
Yep. But,
great book.
I just don't think our bodies are adept at changing to what the society's demanded on us. And
all right. Thanks, Joe.
That's a great comment.
Yeah.
I'd have people go to Google and just click on a view of the world by NASA. And there's some interesting photos of just composite of the world at night taken from space. And when you see light, and in Western societies, how pervasive that is, you're absolutely right, Joe. I mean, we have many more now competing interests during the dark hours than in the past, and that's resulted in probably us getting about 1.5 to 2 hours of sleep less per night over the past 50 years.
Wow. Thanks for calling in.
You bet.
507-282-1234. Janice has a question about food and alcohol. Good morning, Janice.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if eating before bedtime or using alcohol would enhance sleep or interfere with it.
Good question. So I'll take the alcohol first. Alcohol close to bedtime is effective at helping you fall asleep more quickly. It does sedate you. The problem with alcohol before bed is that as it's metabolized, it develops more of an alerting effect. So in the second half of the night, you tend to sleep very fitfully. That is, you're wakening a lot, feel light, in and out of sleep. So alcohol is really a double-edged sword. Helps you fall asleep, doesn't help you stay asleep. As for food, you know, I've always sort of preached to each his own. I think we all know our bodies and understand what may be soothing before bed and help us fall asleep, warm milk being an example for many people. But on the front of food, we generally discourage eating a lot right before bed, and that's because you may then suffer reflux or regurgitation of that food up higher up into the back of the throat while you're lying recumbent or in bed at night, and that can obviously disturb sleep.
There's always been this old wives' tale out there also that if you eat just before you go to bed, you're more likely to gain weight than if you eat earlier in the day. Not true, right?
Well, I think that depends on the overall context of how many calories you're taking.
Is it a huge bowl of ice cream or is it a handful of dry cereal?
Yeah. But it wouldn't matter whether you had that before you went to bed or when you woke up.
Correct. But interesting, you know, those studies we talked about with people being, in an experimental sense, restricted on their sleep. One of the other findings was that there was more snacking after dinner and before bed in some groups of patients that or subjects that are restricted in their sleep. So not getting enough sleep may promote that snacking before bed, which isn't necessarily a great thing for weight control.
507-282-1234. Good morning, Sandy. Go right ahead with your question. Welcome.
Yes. I'm asking about this PM you know, sleep medicine you can get over the counter. And I've been taking it for a long time, and it works for, you know, I can get at least 6 hours of sleep. But everybody's saying it's really bad, and then I cut out the Tylenol, and I still use the antihistamine. Now, is that going to affect my liver and all problems?
Oh, it's Tylenol PM?
Yeah, okay.
So
and are you taking it only for sleep, or are you taking it for pain issues, too?
Well, I was taking it for pain. I had knee surgery, and I thought that's a lot easier than any other medicine, and so I just took the two together. And I just didn't think anything of it, because Tylenol, to me, has always been okay. You know. So I don't know. Maybe it isn't.
So most of those over-the-counter PM medications, like Tylenol PM, have an antihistamine or Benadryl as the PM or sleep-inducing component. By and large, that's very safe, and I wouldn't have you be overly worried about how you've gone for the past few years. However, our experience with drugs like Benadryl is that the effect is very short, and that most people habituate to it in a short period of time. And often when people say, well, I get success with it over the long haul, it's basically serving as part of, again, that learned pattern. You have confidence that you're going to fall asleep when Sure. you take that medication. So how much of a pharmacologic effect versus how much of just the confidence factor you have with that? Hard to know. But if there isn't morning hangover, and heretofore you haven't had side effects related to it, I don't think there's a compelling need that that has to be stopped just because you've been on it for a certain period of time. But how much of a true effect it's having, I guess, is always open to debate in patients.
Right. But it works for you, Sandy.
Yeah, okay.
I'd keep it up.
Okay.
All right.
Thank
yep,
you.
See ya.
And Melissa is on the line. She has something along the same lines about an herbal product. Good morning, Melissa.
Hi. I was wondering about valerian root for helping get to sleep. How safe that was. And
Melissa's got kids and she needs her sleep.
Right. They wake up early, don't they?
So what about that?
Yeah, Melissa, valerian root is one of the agents, non-pharmacologic agents that's been touted for sleep. There are data that suggests there is some effect, positive effect by taking that. I'd have to say we don't routinely use it because the effect seems to be very mild, but there is some evidence that that may be an option.
All right. Does that help you, Melissa?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you there so you much. And we have to talk to Alice because her question is very interesting to me. I think we might be in the same boat here. Good morning, Alice.
Yes.
Go right ahead with your question.
I can't really, unless I'm terribly tired, go to sleep without something like a radio going.
Me too.
Nothing wrong
I got
with
my
that,
radio
huh?
going. Does right. that disrupt your sleep, or does it help to lull you to sleep like a lullaby?
Well, I have to be careful because I don't want to say anything bad about radio being on the radio right now. But, you know, Alice, I think if that works for you, that's fine. In general, we tend to try to decrease noise and light in the bedroom at night. Those things tend for a lot of patients to disrupt sleep. At a level that they may not be aware of. And I suspect this is part of a ritual for you where that helps you get to sleep, and that's obviously important. So I think if it's helping you, and on balance you don't feel any worse for wear in the morning, then just
sometimes
fine.
Listening to the Twins helps me. I fall asleep yeah. listening to baseball, but I'm bombastic political talk show host, maybe not the best.
Well, that's a good point. You know, it may also be the content. So sure. we definitely want people to be winding down before yes. bed. And if what you're listening to is soothing, great. If it makes you upset, then they're not great.
All right. Thanks, Alice.
Thank you.
You know, we were talking about the CPAP for treatment of sleep apnea. That is still the gold standard, right? And it's a machine that you have to purchase and you put it on every night and works pretty well. But what other modalities do you have for sleep apnea?
Yeah, so CPAP does remain the main treatment option for sleep apnea. Remember, sleep apnea is just this narrowing of the throat. So CPAP is a pneumatic splint. That is, it uses air pressure to hold open the throat, just like when you inflate, say, a low car tire.
But so you don't snore and you don't... stop breathing.
Correct. There shouldn't be a peep because your airway is wide open.
Okay.
But it's hard to use, and many patients have been prescribed CPAP only to have it end up in frustration on a shelf somewhere or in the garbage can, as the case may be.
Or at the garage sale.
Yeah, or at yeah. the garage sale or on eBay. And it's hard to use. It's clunky. It takes a while. It's very effective if settled in, but hard. So what else is there? Probably the main thing that we would preach to most patients would be to encourage them to try to lose weight. Remember, weight is the single biggest risk factor for most sleep apneics. And you get
even just a little?
Even just
like
a little.
10 pounds?
Right. So for about every 1% that you lose, or if you like 10% additionally, your sleep apnea gets better by about 3 or 30%, depending on that amount of weight. So you get a big bang for any weight loss buck, even if it's very mild.
And I did put a video that Dr. Eric Olson is in. It's at our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. And it's a video, it's almost 10 minutes long. It's about obesity, hypoventilation. I'd never heard of this before. But how is that tied into apnea?
So some patients that are very overweight do run into a problem where they underbreathe both at night, partly because of sleep apnea, but partly because their brain is unable to ratchet up the breathing in response to all that excess weight that's sitting on the chest.
Your brain doesn't realize that you're overweight.
Correct. So the underbreathing can occur at night, and it then goes into the day as well. So these are patients that have higher carbon dioxide levels. Remember, that's the gas that's created as a result of all the cells in your body metabolizing, and lower oxygen levels because they're just not moving enough air in and out of the lungs. And that's not great for your well-being and your heart health. Those patients typically have sleep apnea, but it's just more than having that throat closing at night. There's more of a systemic problem with handling that weight and its impact on breathing.
It's a great video. If you want a couple of videos from Dr. Olson on sleep, go to radio.mayoclinic.org and you can see those there. And now for our producer, Audrey, does she have to get rid of the pets from her bedroom or not?
So, pets in the bedroom, always a touchy subject because we love our pets. About 40% of pet owners have the pet in the bedroom at night. And pets can be a substantial cause of sleep disruption. So people not getting enough sleep when they wake up from the dog, for instance, jumping on off the bed or whimpering to be let out. So by and large, we would encourage people not to have their pets in the bedroom because they disrupt sleep.
Especially if it's a rattlesnake, right?
Yeah.
How about sleeping pills? There are a lot of them out there, prescription sleeping pills. Do you use those? Do you like them? Do they work for patients? And are there side effects?
Yeah, it's a big topic, but I would say a couple things. First of all, we definitely use sleeping pills in some insomniacs, that is people who have trouble getting to sleep or staying asleep. Using non-drug approaches only gets them so far, and so we do need that help.
And what was the book that you would recommend for people who need help getting to sleep?
Yeah, the caller mentioned No More Sleepless Nights by Peter Howery. Just an excellent book written for the layperson, so it's not a medical text. And it helps the individual who's suffering from poor sleep reflect on what's happening in their experience and then pointing the way to some non-drug approaches to sleeping better. But for some individuals, that just doesn't work enough. And so then we will use sleeping pills, often just in a short-term manner, but sometimes longer haul as well can be safe.
All right, so we've got 30 seconds or so remaining. Your secrets to a good night's sleep.
Make sure the bedroom is comfortable. So good mattress, pets not there, lights down, cool environment. And listen to someone, your bed partner, if they think you have a sleep disorder like sleep apnea, and get that checked out.
And if that's not all working for you, you can always go to the Sleep Disorder Center at the Mayo Clinic. I assume they have one also in Jacksonville, Florida, right?
They do, in Arizona as well.
Very good.
Dr. Eric Olson, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with medical oncologist and ovarian cancer expert, Dr. Paul Haluska.
We're going to sneak this show in the last weekend in September because September is Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month.
Well, I'm glad you told me.
That's why
I'll
got it in there.
I'll be here for sure next week. You know, this used to be known up until a few years ago as the silent killer in the field of cancer, and that's because it was usually found late and it had already spread, and therefore most of the time it was incurable.
The symptoms were so benign, almost. Yes, subtle.
Exactly. But, you know, things have changed. We now know that women are likely to have symptoms in the earliest stages of the diseases before it's spread. Of course, you need to know what those symptoms are so you can go in and see your doctor, because that is the key to an earlier diagnosis, which, of course, is the key to surviving this disease.
Which is why there's Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month, so we can talk about it.
That's right. And if you are diagnosed early, as I mentioned, it's the key. The five-year survival for those women, greater than 90%.
Wow.
So you got to get in to see your physician. We'll talk all about it next week. The symptoms, the diagnosis, the treatment. Mayo Clinic Radio with Dr. Haluska next week.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on these topics, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can see a podcast of the program, some of the videos from Dr. Olson, as well as previous episodes. Or visit us at mayoclinic.com, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers from Mayo help you have a better life.
That's no kidding. You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer and phone screener is Audrey Castletine. Our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
On behalf of Dr. Eric Olson, thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.